This is the Ton Report. I'm your host, Ton Trung. Have you ever had a continuous challenge at work? Something you've really been trying to get done, and it would be really rewarding if you did, but things just never lined up for that to happen. Well, for Quint Davis, a producer of music festivals, there's one band he's been trying to book for years, but something always came up.
Actually, this is the third time we've tried it. We've had them and canceled them twice. Well, they canceled us because they had to. The first time we had them was 2019, and then Mick Jagger had that heart problem, and they canceled the whole tour. We didn't take it personally. They canceled the whole tour. So then we rebooked them again for 2020, and they had this thing called the pandemic. And if you wanted to get a doctor's note to get out of a gig, that was a pretty good doctor's note to get.
Quint is the producer of the annual New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. Most of us just call it Jazz Fest. And the band he's talking about is, of course, the Rolling Stones. Because of their legendary status in the music world, the Stones can be a tough act to land, especially for Jazz Fest, because it's not like many music venues. For example, Jazz Fest is an outdoor music festival that takes place over 2 weekends in the spring, and all the performances are during the day. Quint says that's not the typical setting for the Stones.
So we have to get the artists to agree to play in the daytime without their production. I mean, the Rolling Stones have the biggest production of any band in the world. They only play stadiums. That's all they play, except for May the 2nd, 2024. They'll be playing at a festival.
The Rolling Stones have been that one elusive band that Quint has been trying to bring to Jazz Fest, which has been his baby for decades. So how do you go about getting the Rolling Stones to play in a festival setting in which they're not used to performing?
I have a close relationship with the band, with the people that manage the band, with the people that promote the tours. And I've had that for 20 years, probably. But I've just kept working on it. I mean, a lot of things have to fall together to have that happen. Think about that. They don't tour often. They don't tour the United States that often because they tour Europe. They tour Asia. So if you're in a cycle where they're going to tour America, when is that going to be? It could be any time of year. And no, they're gonna come back and tour the U.S. When are they going to tour the U.S.? Oh, in April and May. Oh, really?
So serendipitous.
So all these things had to fall together to make it work. And then when you get there and you've made a deal, it all goes back to the lead singer. Joyce, the manager's name is Joyce. She asked each Stone individually, do you want to do this? Do you want to do this? Do you want to do this? But I think the lead singer has 2 votes. So they wanted to do it. I mean, if at the bottom line, regardless of the deal or anything, if the band doesn't want to do it, then it's not going to happen. And they've, like I said, they've stuck through it now for about 5 years and 2 cancellations. So it's something they really want to do, and that's the answer to your question.
In New Orleans, we're approaching the heart of festival season. The months following Mardi Gras are always packed with festivals of every kind, and with good reason. Spring down here is pretty magical. The days are warm and sunny, the humidity tolerable. Throw in a bit of a breeze, and you start to understand why there are so many festivals this time of year. Summer down here comes quick, and with it comes oppressive heat, merciless mugginess, and hurricane season. So while we can, we're going to celebrate. And when there's a celebration in New Orleans, there's going to be music. This is where jazz was born, after all. And around these parts, there's no bigger celebration of music than Jazz Fest.
It's such a complex event, you know, it's big, it's really large. And they're building it now, the tents are going up today. So when I get out there in a golf cart and they're building and I ride around, it just blows me away every time. It's not like, oh, same old Jazz Fest, it's amazing.
It's called Jazz Fest, but the kind of music you'll experience at the festival goes far beyond jazz. Some of the bands and musicians at this year's festival include country singer Chris Stapleton, hip-hop's Queen Latifah, and as you heard earlier, the Rolling Stones. That's really just the tip of the iceberg. The festival has 12 stages and stretches over 2 weekends, usually the last weekend of April and the first weekend of May. For decades, those 2 weekends at the New Orleans Fairgrounds have made memories for countless people who've come here for what's truly a New Orleans experience. And delivering that New Orleans experience is something Quint Davis has remained committed to as Jazz Fest is nearing its 55th anniversary. Before the gates at the festival open this year, I sat down with Quint at his office on Canal Street downtown. I wanted to learn more about the man behind all the music and find out what it's like to put on one of the biggest music festivals in the world. Quint was born and raised in New Orleans, and early on, music was always a part of his life.
Well, when I was, I don't know how old, maybe 12 or something like that. Well, actually, I grew up with music in the house on the radio and stuff like that. And then when transistor radios came out, I got one right away. And I would listen to it walking to school. I would put it in my desk and run the wire up my shirt. But I would also, when I was younger than that even, put it under my pillow at night because I was supposed to be sleeping. So my father or somebody would check in and see if I was asleep. Yeah, I was asleep, but I was listening to it under the pillow. And then I'd wake up in the morning and it'd still be on. I'm like, oh, my subconscious is soaking this stuff up.
So what stuff were you listening to all those hours, all those days?
Yeah, I was listening to WBOK. I was listening to R&B stations. And the R&B stations also were the gospel stations at that time. So I was hearing R&B and gospel.
Any particular artist that always caught your fancy?
Yeah. Well, Ray Charles, to begin with. Ray Charles and James Brown were two of my sort of anchors, you know, at the beginning. And then Sam Cooke and Jackie Wilson.
Well, some heavy hitters there.
Yeah, some good ones.
So what part of New Orleans did you grow up in?
Well, you used the term, did I grow up? I'm not sure that's happened yet.
Only you can determine that.
Yeah. Well, we started out, our family, I was the first born. We started out in a little housing kind of complex by the 17th Street Canal. And then we moved out in the Lakeview area. And I guess when I was about five, and stayed there until I was maybe 15, something like that. And then we moved to, well, my parents moved to the French Quarter. They had a house in the French Quarter that my dad had actually, he didn't design it. It was a historic home. And he added another house to it.
And your father was an architect, correct?
My father was an architect, yeah. He architected the Superdome and the arena and Hyatt and Public Library, a few things. So then they moved to Bamboo Road, 5 Bamboo Road, and that was really where I, quote-unquote, grew up and was there through high school. And then supposedly went to college. Really, high school was the only thing I ever graduated from. Because then I started, well, I mean, I went to 2 or 3 colleges for a while.
What'd you major in? Or what did you want to major in?
No, I was in acting and ethnomusicology. Ethnomusicology is the study of the role that music plays in a culture, which was perfect for me. It was my life. I mean, I was already living that life, but I only knew it from being in it. I didn't know it from, you know, an educational angle to be able to look at it professionally, so to speak, as in addition to just living it out. I guess I was living in all the things that I was listening to under the pillow because I was going to every gospel concert that came. I was going to the R&B concerts at Municipal Auditorium. I met some blues guys. I was going to blues clubs. James Rivers, when he was playing on Ferret Street.
Did you ever play music yourself?
No, not really.
No singing?
No, I cannot sing.
Just in the shower, maybe?
No, not really. Well, in the car.
Okay.
When the stereo is really loud. Yes, I do. I sing along in the car.
It was Quint's time at Tulane University that led to a meeting with George Wein, whose work producing and promoting events like the Newport Jazz Festival paved the way for the modern-day music festival.
He knew jazz. He was jazz. I mean, he was a jazz pianist. He had a group. He was the producer. He kind of pioneered outdoor festivals in America when, I think, 1954, he put a stage outdoors on the tennis court at the Newport Lawn and Tennis Club. Gathered together all the jazz musicians he knew because he had a jazz club in Boston. And the name of the jazz club in Boston? Storyville.
No kidding.
No kidding. What a circle, huh? So he gathered up all the musicians from Storyville in Boston, brought them up to Newport and called it the Newport Jazz Festival.
How did you all meet?
So George came down. Well, George first came down and met with a group that wanted a festival just like Newport. And he said, no, well, then get somebody else. And they were like, what? But he said, if you get a festival that's just like Newport, that'll be what you have. That'll be what you always have, a festival just like Newport. But New Orleans has something that no one else in the world can ever claim, and that's the birthright to jazz. And really, he wanted a festival that reflected the Newport Folk Festival more than the Newport Jazz Festival. The Newport Folk Festival, it was small, but they had gospel and they had blues. They had a number of acts that we ended up having in little bitty stages around in a park. And that was the model that he had in mind for a heritage, a New Orleans heritage festival. Really, it's called Jazz and Heritage Festival, but it's really the Heritage of Jazz Festival. So he came down here and he said, well, I know, you know, the regular music, but I'm here to find out the real roots music of New Orleans. You know, the things that I don't know about how to find the jazz funerals and the gospel singers and all these things. He said, I need some kid to go out and find them. And he was meeting with a guy named Dick Allen, who ran the new Tulane Hogan Jazz Archive. And I spent time in the Jazz Archive. I spent more time in the Jazz Archive than I probably did in any classroom. I don't know. But so he told George, well, I have this kid that works up in the archive. I think that's what he does. I don't know how much he goes to school, but I think that's what he does. So he arranged for me to meet with George, I think at Café Du Monde one morning. And George said, I need somebody to go out and find. And I knew nothing about the business. I never worked on a show, never worked on a stage, anything. I was just living my life out there in the music community. He said, I need a kid to go out and find all these musics for a festival. I said, well, I know those people. Not that I've ever booked them. I don't know what booking is, really, at that point. But I said, I know those people, and I'll get them all to come. And he said, okay. I think I got $500 and a handshake or something like that. And the rest is history.
I mean, clearly you had the love of music, but you had really no knowledge of putting on a festival or music production, really, correct?
Correct. I had no knowledge of a festival, what a festival really was, and any parts of the business. And George just, you know, saw what I just threw me in.
You're a college kid for all intents and purposes with no experience. Mr. Ween calls you, and then you have the first jazz festival. For those of us that weren't around for it, what was that like?
It was very cool. Because of it had all the same elements that the festival has now, amazingly enough. Because we had four stages. We had a gospel tent, which was just a tent top, no sound system, an upright piano in the grass, and a couple of microphones. And so we had a gospel tent, and we had Cajun, we had Zydeco, we had bluegrass, we had funk, of course, R&B. I had the original meters on there.
Nice.
And we had food, Buster Holmes cooking red beans and rice, and we had art. Bruce Bryce was doing his art there, and we collected art, started the first poster. So it was in the square that's behind the Mr. Auditorium.
Congress
Square? The square behind the Mr. Auditorium at that time was Beauregard Square.
Because still the things
in New Orleans were named after Confederate generals and stuff like that. But in actuality, it was Congo Square, where African music was first played in America and became jazz. Well, it not really became jazz, but African music was allowed to be played on Sundays. So you'd have all kind of different Africans who never really got together in Africa, but had been brought here, you know, from different places. And they could go play and sing and really do ceremonies and all kinds of stuff. And I think the power rhythms that they were playing eventually got sort of condensed by the pressure cooker of slavery or being in America, and they created a beat, and a beat was born, and that's, you know, popular music. But that beat became the second line, and that, which is New Orleans's beat, and that became the music of the jazz funeral, and everything went from there. So ancestrally, for us to be putting down our music on the sacred ground of Congo Square was just fantastic. And it was just coincidental, really, because that George was doing night shows inside the Municipal Auditorium. That was the auditorium in New Orleans at that time. And this Beauregard Square, quote-unquote, was attached to it. So it only made sense to have the little fair in the little yard that was behind, because at that point, the concerts were the real festival. This little thing out in the yard was just a little thing out in the yard, which grew. So it made sense to have it there. As it turned out, we were in Congo Square.
Following that first Jazz Fest in 1970, Quint went on an amazing musical journey, thanks to his relationship with George Wein.
He sent me on a tour with Duke Ellington behind the Iron Curtain, Duke's first tour behind the Iron Curtain. And it was me and one other guy. We were the tour managers. And we did like 34 shows in 32 nights. I didn't know what a tour was. I'd never seen a tour before. Never seen one like that since, actually. And then he sent me up to Newport, and that was the year of the riot, and they were like setting the stage on fire. And I said, well, this is a really interesting sort of job here. But George took me under his wing, you know, and I started learning from him and just being in the situation that he put me in. I took B.B. King to Africa for the first time in history and just did a lot of great things that George put me to do.
I have to say, you must have been like a pig in poop.
Oh, absolutely.
Doing all that stuff, right?
I took B.B. King to Africa. When I was told that I was going to be a tour manager for B.B. King, I just couldn't believe it.
I mean, you made it, I'd imagine.
It was like fantasy becoming reality, because I loved B.B. King. I had one 45 record, Rock Me Baby, that he put out on a Gray Kent label. And I would put the arm over. At that time, we had an arm to put the records on. And so it would play over and over and over and over. And I'd just listen to it and dance around, listen to it and dance around. And then somebody calls me and says, you're going to Africa with B.B. King. And it's just like, that'd be like if I was collecting baseball cards as a kid, and I get a call saying, the Yankees are in the World Series, we need you to come up and pitch a game. That's the equivalent of me going to Africa with B.B. King.
Jazz Fest eventually moved from Congo Square to the fairgrounds, and the production duties shifted from George Wein to Quint.
When do you think you hit your stride as a producer of music festivals? Like, was there a time where you said, you know, I kind of get this?
I don't know. Ask me in a month. I'm starting to catch on. No, I don't know if I ever thought of it like that. I just, you know, was just doing whatever he told me, whatever I had to do. And then, well, at some point, that's a really good question, because he started to, you know, withdraw a little bit, hands-on, withdraw a little bit. And to pretty much where he and I talked a lot, and he would advise me and stuff like that. But it came to the point that we formed a different company. The company that we were doing it under was his company, Festival Productions, Inc., which was in New York. And eventually, we formed a new separate company, Festival Productions, Inc., New Orleans, which was George and I. And I think that's when it occurred to me that I was doing this.
About what year was that, do you think? Like, are we talking 80s, 90s?
It would have been, I guess, 80s. Yeah.
So that's really when you kind of took the leadership role of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you have this reputation now that Jazz Fest universally has across the world. Is it easier now to get acts? Kind of take us into that process of like calling up artists like Foo Fighters or Wu-Tang Clan and say, hey, you know, would you like to come down? Or are they asking you?
It's easier, but it's exponentially more expensive. They want to play, otherwise you can't get them. And now, well, what we have now is two things, really, now that you ask. I hadn't thought of it that way. We have the acts that we want, and we have the acts that the agencies now want to put on Jazz Fest. It's important to the agents to get their acts on the festival. And so there's a lot of pressure from the agencies to put on the acts that they want. And we actually have to have the acts that we want, because we're doing the festival.
So are the agencies putting pressure on you, like, hey, you need to get this act on there?
Oh, absolutely. Not even so much, hey, you know, because particularly when they help you get one of their biggest acts, then they want you to sort of pick up another couple of acts, which we have to fight off. But now, yes, the acts want to play, and that doesn't mean they will, because there's so many variables. You know,
they're on tour, whether they're
are
available.
They working, are they healthy, are they still together, are they recording, did they take a break? So if they're actually, the first thing to find out is, are they available before you go any further? So we check avails. And then, like I say, we have these two lists, one the people we want, one the people that are being pushed at us. But we do have sort of a crisis in the last 10 years, maybe. I lose track of time with what's happened with talent prices. The talent prices, even in the last year, the last 2 years, the last 3 or 4 years, talent prices are just have gone up and up and up and up and up and up.
Give us an idea, though. What are we talking? Hundreds of thousands, millions? What are we dealing with?
Yeah, all the above. The other festivals, they charge like $150, $145 to get in. And we were sitting here with $25 tickets, $35 tickets. Finally, we got up to, I think, a $45 ticket. But because we looked like a festival, they wanted to charge us the same amount of money that they were charging these big rock festivals. And we couldn't pay what they were paying, what the rock festivals were paying. I mean, even now, this year, we were selling tickets to Jazz Fest for $80, $85. There's no big festival like this that sells a ticket for $85. But that partly goes to the fact that the festival is owned by a 501c3 nonprofit, and they have a big responsibility, they feel, to the community and to keep the festival accessible.
And still, though, I'm sure you've heard even locals say, man, I remember when I used to go to Jazz Fest and pay $30 or $40.
Or $15.
Yeah, and it's way too...
$12.
And it's way too expensive now. What do you tell those folks now when they say Jazz Fest has just gotten to a point where the locals can't enjoy it?
Well, we give out 10,000 free tickets to begin with, trying to make sure that we reach the people that really can't afford anything. But I don't think the cost of the festival is any different than the cost of anything else from what they remember. Cars were $2,400, you know, gas was 10 cents a gallon. So the rest of the world, we're still in the world. and the prices have gone up, and it's all relative, I think, to what other things cost. I mean, to go to a concert, the same people that are saying that, ironically, I don't know if irony is the right word for it, but they go to the concerts at the Smoothie King and pay $350 and $250.
For not a great seat.
Yeah, for not a great seat. And so the cost of entertainment, that's for one act. We're putting 73 acts a day out at the festival. And a good, I don't know, 5 or 10 of them, you know, you'd have to pay over $100 to see them. So in reality, in the entertainment industry that we're in, like I say, the tickets are selling for $200 to see one act for an hour and a half. And they'll go do that, but you're right, they'll remember. I remember when the Jazz Fest was $15.
So obviously, you know, there's so many things, so many stages to enjoy. I personally love the gospel and blues tent.
Yeah.
Mainly because of the music, but it's also a great place to get some shade and, you know, you get some misting in there. What about you? Like, what do you enjoy most when the fest is actually kicking off and you're in swing? Like, do you find yourself at a particular stage that
all
you enjoy
of them.
Most?
Yeah. All of them. I like the... Well, for one thing, I want to know, you know, I want to hear the group, hear them live. If there's somebody that I haven't heard much of, I want to see what the relationship is with the audience and how the show's going. I want to see if they're in the right spot. Should they have been on earlier? Should they have been on later? Are they in the right stage? And then I just want to hear them. Because, you know, I like the music on the festival. I picked it. So I didn't pick anything I hate.
So in a way, you kind of have to...
I circulate. I have a golf cart, and I go from stage to stage.
You kind of have to evaluate it critically for yourself. So it's
somewhat
work as well.
Yeah. Well, hopefully by the time we've reached the point that the bands are actually coming to the festival, you know, that the people that I work with who do the booking, they're really good. They know what they're doing. We work together. And our real bottom line, if we have a bottom line for bands, is kind of musicianship. Like, regardless of what genre you are, can you really play an instrument? Can you really sing? Because there's a lot of people out there that can't do that really, you know, too well, that made their way onto festivals. But so...
In this particular festival, you can't be lip syncing and there can't be really effects. I mean, you're on stage and that's it.
You're on stage in the daytime, in daylight, under a tent. I mean, get the Rolling Stones and tell them where you're going to play under a tent in the afternoon. You really got to want to do that. It's sort of stripped bare, to your point. I mean, you're there, the audience is there, there's not a spotlight in their face or something, or yours. You know, they're looking right at you, everyone. It's part of the magic of the festival for the that makes the music so great, is that you sort of have eye contact. It's like being on a Mardi Gras float.
And like Mardi Gras, Jazz Fest brings in people from across the country and from around the world. Ed Bradley, who was a 60 Minutes correspondent for decades, was also a faithful festival guy. Bradley died in 2006. The following year, during the fest, there was a jazz funeral for Bradley at the fairgrounds. He was named as an ancestor of the festival, joining New Orleans music icons like Louis Armstrong and Mahalia Jackson. Quinn says New Orleans, and especially Jazz Fest, had a special place in Bradley's heart.
Oh, well, he loved Jazz Fest. Ed Bradley was friends with Jimmy Buffett. And Jimmy Buffett was playing the festival and told Ed, you got to come down, you got to come down to this thing. So he came down with Jimmy, and back in, I don't know what years they were, but they were fun years. They were kind of wild years.
With Jimmy Buffett, I'd imagine it was fun.
Yeah, it was fun. We were all fun. Ed had started out, he had been a disc jockey in Philadelphia, and he'd been a music person his whole life. So, you know, when Jimmy said, you're going to love this, he knew what he was talking about. And once Ed saw it, he had two connections. He had the festival and the Neville Brothers. And he really connected with the Neville Brothers. And he would get up and play a cowbell or beat a tambourine with them or sing a little backup. He just loved it. He loved New Orleans. He loved the culture. He loved the food. He'd have the sweet potato pone people make him a whole tray of it to take with him when he went home. I mean, he was dug in. And I started getting him to do some of the introductions of the bands, you know. Actually, we did a documentary on Louis Armstrong, and he was the host. He did an incredible interview with Wynton Marsalis, one of the best I've ever heard. And Wynton said, well, what about Louis Armstrong for you modern guys, you know? And Wynton said, yeah, you know, when we were young, we started out, we were thinking about Jim Crow and all that kind of stuff. He said, but then I tried to play it. And I said, No, Ed Bradley became part of the festival family. He's one of the ancestors in the ancestor plot. So he was really close. He never missed one.
Would you consider him a friend back then?
Oh, yeah. We were friends from the first time we met.
I asked Quint if he ever pinches himself because of where his musical journey has taken him. From putting the radio under the pillow at night as a kid to booking the Rolling Stones for Jazz Fest. He told me all he was thinking about was when the gates at the fairgrounds would open and making sure that the festival was ready to roll. When I met with him, they were in the middle of transforming the fairgrounds from a horse racing venue to a mecca for music.
What do you do before Jazz Fest? Like, what goes on with you?
What goes on with me? Well, there's always things bubbling up, you know, things that, because I work directly with the talent department. We always have things that are happening that have to be fixed. I just really check in with everybody. And now that the thing is being built, the festival is being built, it's kind of a thing to me. I'll go out there every day and just check in and see how everything's going. I mean, I don't have an actual wrench in my hand or anything like that. But
you've earned it, I suppose.
just to be a part of it, you know. I get just as excited, just as thrilled now as I ever did in any of those other years. And so I'm looking forward to it happening again. And I'm really excited to see the festival come back to life. Because my most emotional moment, so to speak, is when the gates open. The festival's been hibernating for a year. We've been in here in the hive, working. So you go out there and you build this city. I think it's the sixth largest city in Louisiana when it gets really big. But still, it's empty. It's a lot of stages and food booths. So it's vibrating, but it's still empty. Now, once the gates open, the festival comes to life because it's the people that give it life, the New Orleans people. I mean, we welcome everybody. People, you know, from all over the world come now, but we really still think of it as a New Orleans festival for New Orleans people. And that kind of drives the music choices, too, you know, kind of knowing what New Orleanians would like. So when the gates open, the people come in, the festival's back on. And that's my number one thing. I like every second of it when it's on.
What's the future look like for Jazz Fest? Because it seems like it's a festival that sells itself. I'm sure I'm minimizing the great efforts that your entire team does here, but Where else can you go with Jazz Fest?
Where else can you go?
Yeah, what else can you do with Jazz Fest that you haven't done already?
Well, we're not going to go at night. We're a daytime event. And actually, Jazz Fest at night, the music scene in New Orleans during Jazz Fest, with all the clubs and everything, that's really become, in a way, a part of Jazz Fest.
Absolutely.
Even though it's not Jazz Fest, that people go to the festival during the day, and then they go out at night and they go to all the clubs. And that clubs, if we ran, we could run the festival to midnight or 1 in the morning, and it would kind of kill all that scene. So we never did want to do that. And then the neighbors wouldn't have liked it, you know. We'd have to go through City Hall. No, we like it right where it is.
And this year you added an extra day.
We added an extra day.
Are there plans to go even more beyond that in the future years?
No, not right now. I've wanted to balance up and have 2 4-day weekends for a while. And we tried it. Every time we tried it, there was some kind of disaster. You know, we tried it twice. First time was 9/11. Nobody would travel. Nobody would fly. Then the next time we did it for the 50th anniversary. 2019, we went to 8 days, and it worked, and people loved it. And then pandemic. Then there was no festival for 2 years, and we had to start over. The festival, these days, you know, you talk about adding a day, but we didn't just add a day, we added a Thursday. And Thursday is what's become known as Locals Day. Because on Thursday, you can come and get a ticket to Jazz Fest for $50. All these people would say, well, it's too expensive, I can't go. Well, come on Thursday. You know, and a lot of people do. It's very popular. I mean, we sell tens of thousands of tickets to local people on what we call Local Thursday.
So what you're telling me, there's not going to be a third weekend of Jazz Fest.
There's not going to be a third
weekend. May sound great on paper, but that sounds like a ton of work as well.
Well, no, it's not that there's so much work. I mean, once you're doing two, you can do three. It'd be a lot of work for us. But once it's built and it's operating and everything's out there, and the plumbing's there, the electricity's there, the food booths have all moved in, the stages are up. You could do another weekend, but you're talking about another weekend in the middle of May going into summer. That
could be a dice roll.
I don't think it's a dice roll. I think it's a disaster. Because then you're getting into the summer heat and the summer rain. We probably would go earlier if we could, a week or two earlier if we could, but we can't because of the racing season. The dates of the festival really are determined by the racing season, because it takes us about a month to build the thing from the last day of racing.
Even with all that planning and preparation, a successful Jazz Fest can often hinge on one factor.
I mean, the main thing with the business is the weather. That's the determinant. I mean, everything that we do is all determined by does it rain or not in 2 weeks.
That's the funny thing, because in New Orleans, you can be a Mardi Gras person or a Jazz Fest person, but either way, usually the weather determines both.
The weather determines us a lot more than Mardi Gras, I think, because people don't have to buy a ticket.
And because people buy tickets and have traveled to see the artists they adore, sometimes even a torrential downpour won't send them running. That's what happened during one of Stevie Wonder's performances at Jazz Fest. It's among Quint's all-time favorites.
Oh, so many.
I bet.
Well, there's one with Stevie, for sure. The year he got rained out, and there was 2 or 3 feet of water out in the field.
I was there.
And they were telling me, Stevie wants to play. And I'm telling him, he can't play. And I was getting ready to put up on the screens, you know, it's over, go home. And one of his guys comes and says, Stevie's coming up. Yeah, he's coming on stage. So there was no PA system. So he was going to pantomime and do something. And I said, get a bullhorn, get a microphone, get something. And I ended up with this little, like, $20 plastic bullhorn thing. But it was the year that Prince died. And he led the entire festival field up to their knees in water singing Purple Rain. That one will stay with me.
With all the time that he spent pursuing the Rolling Stones, this year's festival is shaping up to be a memorable one for Quint. Jazz Fest kicks off on Thursday, April 25th. And if you're planning on going, pray for sunny skies. But bring your rain gear just in case. In New Orleans, I'm Ton Trung for WWL Radio.